This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk, and today we have a very special guest. He writes historical thrillers. His name is Philip Carr, and his new Bernie Gunther novel is called A Man Without Breath. Hello.
Hello, David.
All the way from London, you are.
Yes, via probably about 10 cities in the United States on my book tour.
I'm sitting here outside on my patio enjoying this book. This is such a great book. I mean, it's just so enjoyable to see. I mean, it's very historical. And are all the places real places in the book?
Oh, yes, yes. Wherever possible, I use real places and real historical characters. I keep the sort of fictional ones almost to a minimum, so that the places, the real places and the real people outweigh the made up ones. It's because I like to sort of make a novel something that can be educational as well as entertaining.
Right.
So I try and make everything as real as possible.
And Hitler makes a brief show in the book too, which is cool.
I mean, he does. Yes, he's making a short speech, which by his standards was short anyway.
Are you a big history buff?
Oh yes. I especially more recently as well. I mean, I've always liked history, but I think history's got better lately. Historians seem to be trying that much harder to write entertaining books as well as informative ones. A good example, Eric Larson, who wrote a very good book called In the Garden of the Beast.
Oh, yeah.
Simon Sebag Montefiore, who wrote a terrific biography of Stalin. It seems like they've been reading a lot of novels, I've been reading a lot of history, so perhaps at some stage we'll all meet in the middle.
And I mean, you know, reading this book, that you've done a lot of research, and I don't know who designs your books, but they do such a great job. I mean, I love to just sit and look at. I don't know who the pretty girl is on the cover, but she's beautiful.
She is rather nice, actually, isn't she? She looks like the classic sort of 40s femme fatale, you know, as if she's lying on a sort of chaise longue in Philip Marlowe's office.
Well, they have like a satiny feel, the covers of your books, which is it's so nice the way they design them, you know?
They do, yeah. I mean, I guess maybe they're just spending more money on me than they used to.
That's because you write good stuff, really good stuff, and they're selling.
Thank you. Well, so I'm not doing badly. I mean, I like to think that my book tour has had some effect, but you never know.
Yeah. I mean, this book is over 400 pages long, so did it take you a long time to write this one? Does it take you a long time to write these?
It didn't take that long. I guess it took me about a year, which in sort of normal terms isn't such a long time. It sounds like a long time to anybody who's not writing. But once I get started, I find it very difficult to stop, and I guess it doesn't feel like work, put it that way.
Are you writing 7 days a week when you're writing?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, I remember, on more than one occasion, I've sneaked down to my office on Christmas Day and have actually sort of written half a page. So, yeah, I am a bit of a compulsive novelist, actually. I mean, I've been doing this since I was, like, not professionally, but I've been writing since I was a kid of 10.
Wow.
So, you know, it was my hobby then, and I'm one of those very, very lucky people who gets paid to do his hobby.
Well, Bernie Gunther is such an interesting man. We think we know the way he is, and then he does something really unexpected in this book. I don't want to give it away because it'll ruin one of the plot lines, but he does something I didn't see coming at all, and it really shocked me. So we don't always know the way he's going to react.
Well, true. And in defense of him, without giving it away, it's like that sort of moral choice that we're often asked to, you know, to make ourselves. If you could go back in history and say kill Hitler, would you do it? I mean, it's you know, none of us likes to think we're capable of murder, but in certain circumstances, you know, I think we would find ourselves more than equal to the task. I know I would. So I kind of wanted to sort of confront that little moral dilemma myself in some way in the course of this particular book. And I mean, let's face it, he's also on the Eastern Front in 1943, where it's, you know, you're surrounded with death and destruction. It must have been quite easy, I think, for your own moral code to sort of be slowly eroded.
And what I find really interesting, too, is you don't write these books in order of how they happen. You pick a different time for each one and do that.
I mean, there's good reason for that, because, I mean, I like... when I came back to the series after a long time, I thought I could sort of treat the reader with a little bit more intelligence than sometimes they do get treated, you know, so I thought they could easily take me shifting around the time frame. But just as importantly, I wait on the sources, as it were, and, you know, it takes a while sometimes for just the right book to come along that sort of helps you a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
In the beginning, when I first started, there was a sort of a dearth of information on the subject, and more recently, there's been a publishing explosion in the subject matter. But even so, I mean, there's not an awful lot about the Cat in the Forest massacre, and it was really, you know, the discovery of an old map that sort of kick-started me with this one. But that's really the reason why I shift around. I mean, I'd always wanted to write about the Cat in Forest, but just never had the material that would enable me to do it.
Mm-hmm. You were born in Edinburgh. Now, how often do you get over to the States for a book tour anyway? Is this the first?
Well, I come a lot. I mean, I come at least once a year for business. And,
oh, do you?
Yeah, and then I come... I go to Hollywood a fair bit because, I always entertain hopes of working in movies. So I come a lot, and I always enjoy it when I come. And in the course of, you know, to the last 20, 25 years, I've been on many research trips for, you know, other novels that had nothing to do with Bernie Gunther. So I sort of feel I know your country pretty well, actually.
Right. Well, we're glad to have you, because you're very talented as a writer. I mean, there's parts of this book, the part that takes place in the bathroom, it was just... for some reason, that one's sticking with me. I just love that whole scene, and it's, you don't realize what's happening until all of a sudden you're like, uh-oh, this is really a major moment in the book, you know?
In where, did you say?
In the bathroom, the scene in the bathroom.
Oh, right.
With the last stall, and I thought, oh my goodness, you know, I don't want to give anything away. I want my readers to experience it.
I do like sort of being unpredictable.
Then it really makes the scene wonderful, because you're like, what's going to happen, you know, and you have to read on. If you have to go to the bathroom, I don't. You lose the whole tempo of the scene if you're not reading it from beginning to end, you know.
Yes, well, that was quite nasty, actually.
Yeah, there's some nasty part. There are some very grisly parts in this book.
Well, yeah, and that's probably why I sort of leaven the grisly parts with Bernie's sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
He's got quite a black, noirish, wry sense of humor. And that's one of the things that keeps me going when I'm writing. And I think it's probably one of the reasons why readers like reading it too. Because, you know, if it was all doom and gloom, it would leave you feeling rather dispirited. But there are occasional sort of flashes of wit.
Right.
To make it seem like it's actually almost tolerable.
I have to ask you, on page 202, he makes a comment to Rudikov, and I don't understand what it means. It must be in Russian. It starts with K-A-K. I can't even say it. It's hard to say in Russian. Kak, Shaz, Hesh.
I don't have the book in front of me right now. He does actually make some Russian... I mean, if it's in Russian, it's probably there for a sort of very similitude, for a sense of there being people who are actually speaking Russian rather than actually sort of meaning anything crucial.
Right.
I sort of put that sort of thing in. And if I leave it in Russian, it's probably not that important. It's just there to sort of give us
a sense of the place. I guess I'm a purist. I like to know what everything means.
I don't blame you, actually. But, I mean, I'm always inspired in this particular instance by, you know, sort of Raymond Chandler, you know, because, I mean, in Chandler's books, quite often you really don't know what's happening. And you read it, but you read on, because in a sense, all that matters is at the end is that you have a sense that the the hero has understood it.
Right. So you like more than just historical thrillers yourself. You read mysteries?
I don't read that many. I mean, I read the greats like Hammett and Chandler and one or two others. Elmore Leonard, I think, is one of the best.
Mm-hmm.
I don't read many novels at all now. I read mostly histories, but occasionally pick up a novel. More often than not by F. Scott Fitzgerald, actually, to sort of inspire me. You know, if I'm sort of thinking, gosh, how did he start this a paragraph, or how did he end something? I look to him as almost as the sort of master. I think every writer has a favorite that they go to for a little bit of, almost like a little bit of advice. You know, it's like sort of having him standing over your shoulder and saying, well, you know, have you thought of, you know, starting a paragraph that way, or finishing a chapter in this fashion?
It's interesting. The book ends on my birthday, May 3rd, which is really, I find kind of, it's amazing. I mean, that I looked at it and I said, I wonder if it ends on my birthday, because I knew it was going through April. And sure enough, the last day is May 3rd. And I'm like, wow, how cool is that?
Ending, I mean, I won't say what the ending is, obviously, but it sort of came out of nowhere almost. I mean, sometimes I have slightly more drawn out endings.
Mm-hmm.
That are almost like sort of epilogues.
So are you writing for yourself, or are you writing for your audience, for who's reading you?
Well, in that, I'm always writing for myself in the sense that I hope that what I write for myself will please my audience.
Right.
But sometimes, you know, if a novel's working well, and it should sort of work organically, and it should kind of lead you by the hand.
Well, do your readers ever come to you and say, I don't like the way you ended that, or I don't like the way that was done? Do they ever say that to you?
I occasionally get someone who sort of thinks, oh, well, I don't think he would have done that or something like that. But, I mean, on the whole, I think people respect that, you know, you are the author after all. And, you know, they place yourself in their hands. And I think, but at the same time, I do respect what readers want. You know, I think my duty, I feel, is always to first to be entertaining and to be interesting. And I don't. While I feel sometimes I do have a message, if you like, I like to leave it well, sort of buried within the text.
Now, this is number 8 in the Bernie Gunther series.
No, it's number 9.
Number 9. Okay.
Yes.
I thought I started by 8 and 9, but the first 3 were they put together in a trilogy? What do they call Berlin Noir?
Berlin Noir. Yeah. I mean, I wrote the first one, and I mean, really, at the time I was just deliriously happy just to get published, and mm-hmm. I hadn't actually thought of writing a second one, and my publisher and agent both said to me simultaneously, you should really write another one.
Right.
So I did, and then having written 2, I wrote a third. And then I thought, well, you know, I didn't become a writer just to write the same thing all the time. So I had a long period off doing lots of other kind of writing before I came back to the character. And I mean, you know, to be honest, I'm always haunted by the possibility that I've written too many. And I think if you're any kind of writer or an artist, you should always be willing, ready, braced, if you like, to sort of chuck the whole thing aside and start to do something different. I think that's, there are too many people just sort of, I think, who are, if you like, sort of career writers who just sort of looking to cash in on one thing and stick with it.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's making money.
I think some of it depends on how entertaining the novels are. I mean, if they stop being entertaining, what's the point anymore, you know? You have to be entertaining, and this book's very entertaining.
Yeah.
I'm just really enjoying reading. I'm wondering what the title means, A Man Without Breath. Should I know already what the title is, or is it something?
Well, quite often these things are put in as a little text at the beginning of the novel, and it's there. It's actually from, it's a quote from Goebbels's novel. He wrote a novel called Michael in
right.
the 1920s when he was a struggling sort of student, and well, what a big surprise when after he became Minister of Enlightenment Propaganda, he found a publisher. So the title comes from a quote in Goebbels's book. He's actually not a bad wordsmith in some ways, because I've used a quote from him before in a previous novel, which was called A Quiet Flame.
Interesting.
And, you know, people also have a perception of Goebbels being a sort of you know, rabble-rousing madman, which of course to some extent he was, but there's another side to Goebbels which is also revealed in this book, which is the smooth, articulate, intelligent Goebbels.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, these evil people, they have a good side to them, too. They have a side that you could still be interested in.
Well, they have a seductive side, yes, because, I mean, you know, it has to be admitted, and it isn't admitted often enough, that they persuaded a very large number of a very well-educated people
mm-hmm.
to vote for them. And that they wouldn't have been able to do that if they'd come on day one like a bunch of sort of total madmen.
But would you say that you're still enjoying writing the series?
Yes.
Today, just as much? I mean,
yes, I am. And I think, you know, it comes out in the books. I mean, if you're not enjoying it, if it's a chore, then that always comes out in the book. There's no way you can hide that. So as long as you're enjoying it, I think that sort of is communicated in the text.
Well, now that I'm more than halfway through it, I'm almost three quarters of the way down, I guess, now. And now that this major thing is happening, I'm wondering, ooh, is something going to happen as a result of that? And that makes the book even more interesting, because once that really heavy thing happens, you want to know what's going to happen next. What's going to happen as a result of that?
Yes.
I mean,
one of the reasons I did this, but the thing you're talking about that we're not going to give away,
right.
is I don't always, you see, heroes who always act heroically are kind of dull, let's face it. And you know, so, I mean, one of the reasons I like writing about Bernie Gunther is that he's got a dark side, and he occasionally does things that he's not particularly proud of. And to that extent, it makes for a more interesting novel. I think, you know, novels are more interesting when characters do things that, you know, we're not expecting, and perhaps they are rather uncomfortable with.
Yeah, he has a conscience, and we wonder, did Hitler have a conscience? Did Hitler ever feel bad about anything?
I think, honestly, no. I think Hitler was Hitler's problem was that he always thought he was right. He was single-minded, seemed to have no conscience at all, right up until the end. I mean, you know, at the end, you know, when he wrote his last will and testament, none of it was his fault. It was actually the German people, it turned out, had not been worthy of his leadership.
Now, what year did he die?
1945.
1945, okay.
Spring 1945.
So not long after this book took place, and then a couple of years, but
yes.
But he's such a fascinating. And there was something on AOL today about Hitler. They were talking about, you know, how I'm not sure what exactly. I didn't read the whole thing, but it was one of those news items that goes by, and they were talking about why he had so much power and what it was about him that, you know, and whatnot, all the stuff he didn't know.
German people were possessed. And what you can, I think, I mean, the reasons for the rise of Nazism are so complex
mm-hmm.
That it's often hard to sort of pick any one thing out. But I think if I was to pick one thing out, it would be that people in the late 1920s, early 1930s had such a terrible fear of communism and Bolshevism and Joseph Stalin. You know, it's often forgotten that at the time Hitler came to power, and two or three years up to that time, Stalin was busy deliberately starving the people of the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
And as many as, in order to sort of, for some political point, promote the industrialization of Russia, and 5 million Ukrainian people were deliberately starved to death. Now, if that's happening more or less on your doorstep, it doesn't half sharpen your resolve never to have communists in charge of your government. And I suspect that many people were driven into the arms of the Nazis simply out of fear of what they saw as a possible alternative.
Right. Now, it's funny thing is, at the beginning of this book, you know, when you see all the food rationing and people were starving, and it was kind of depressing in the beginning. I thought, oh, this is going to be really depressing. And then before I knew it got more and more interesting. And I was forgetting about the beginning of the book. I was getting into the story more. So I was enjoying that more, which I found interesting. Because at the beginning I thought, this is going to be a very depressing book. But it isn't. It's a very interesting book.
Well, I'm glad you say that, because I think history, well, I like to find the history that we don't particularly know very well, and it fascinates me, and I always think, well, if this fascinates me, then I'm sure other people will be fascinated too. You know, for instance, it fascinated me that the man who discovered the first body in the Katyn forest of Polish officers who'd been murdered by the Russian secret police, that he should be an aristocratic colonel of intelligence. And I wanted to know more about him. And then very quickly I discovered that virtually on the day he discovered the Katyn Forest massacre grave, in the previous 3 months he'd been involved in as many plots to kill Hitler. So once I sort of found that out, that was really... that fascinated me sufficiently to sort of drive me on to write this story.
Right, exactly. I love some of the names of the town, like Krasny Bor. I love that. I love that name. There's something about that name.
These are real places. I mean, that's the hard graft part of writing a novel like this, is to track down the real places and to sort of write about them and describe them. I mean, that had been a health resort. See, the Germans were always very good at finding the best places to stay after they conquered the place. And it was like when they went to Paris in 1940 and they took over all the five-star hotels. And mm-hmm. each branch of the German services, be it Air Force, SS, Army, they all took over a posh hotel and lived it up.
Right.
So Krasny Bor was the nearest thing to a kind of luxury spa that existed in that part of the world.
Now,
and became the headquarters.
You talk about Bernie Gunther. That I think I read somewhere that you weren't sure how much longer you could write the series, and how much more there was to say about it. But I wonder, do you know what ultimately happens to him?
No, not at all. And I'm always slightly distrustful of writers who say they've got the whole thing mapped out. Seven books in advance and all that kind of stuff. To me, that would make it really dull.
Right.
If I knew what was going to happen in the end, then I'd kind of I would kind of remove my will to sort of carry on writing them. I like to sort of surprise myself at the same time as I surprise the reader. So nothing is set in stone, really.
Well, do you think you'll know when you're going to write the last book? I mean, do you think before you write the last one, you'll say to yourself, this is going to be the last one in the series?
Well, I recently finished a children's series, which lasted...
Children of the Lamp.
Yes. And I hadn't realized until about at least a third of the way through that book that it would indeed be the final one of the series.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me it was information that was presenting itself. It was almost like the characters were telling me that this was actually a rather elegant way to end the story.
So you think Bernie will be the same way?
Yeah, I wouldn't be at all surprised. I mean, you have to listen to the characters that you've created and let them sort of partly control their own destiny.
Now, some of the characters in this book were real people. Of course, Goebbels was real and Hitler was real, but are all of the characters real names?
I'd say more than 90% are, yes.
Really? They're real people that...
Well, all of the German officers, bar one or two,
mm-hmm.
are real, based on real people.
You've really done your research.
The generals, the field marshals, the colonels, the captains, they're almost all real. Even one or two of the Russians are real, there wasn't much information
mm-hmm.
about them. But one or two of them are. I do like to sort of find out as much as possible, and then use those real characters if possible. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, sorry.
If you use those characters as well, I thought you were going on with your story. I'm sorry about that. I'm wondering if you read other historical writers, like Alan Furst is another one that's pretty well known. I mean, do you read his stuff?
Well, no, I don't. I don't, and it's not because I don't think they're any good. You know, him and David Downing and one or two. It's just that I'm always worried that I might read something of theirs that I came away thinking that was real history.
Right.
And they might have made it up. I don't know. So I prefer to work in a vacuum.
Right.
I wouldn't also, I prefer not to be influenced by any. anything they've done, so that, you know, they might have a really good idea, and then it might really irritate me that I couldn't do something similar myself. So I think I much prefer just to sort of plow my own furrow, you know, and without looking over my shoulder at what they're doing.
Well, I like the fact in this book there's actually a sort of an attempt on Hitler's life too, which is really interesting, because I guess there were a lot of those in the day.
There were indeed. I mean, between, you know, the sort of mid 1920s and 1944, there were probably as many as 30 different plots to kill him, many of which he found out about. And this is one of the reasons why he believed in his own sense of destiny, because he felt he'd been spared again and again and again to lead the German people, and therefore he couldn't be contradicted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was the very failure of the many plots that sort of helped persuade Hitler he was, the messiah that Germany had been waiting for.
Now, your books, where do they sell the best? Here or overseas or where you've come from, London?
Well, they do sell pretty well here, I've got to say. And, you know, it's, but it's taken a long time, David. I mean, you know, when I first stopped writing these, I remember going to the Strand bookstore in New York and seeing in the basement a whole sort of shelf of remainder copies of all my early books. So it's taken a long time for it to be a success.
You're a success, and I know you credit Marion Wood for that. Marion Wood is the imprint on your book.
And yeah, she's been great.
She has her own
part. You need other people around you to sort of, you know, spur you on and encourage you. And yeah, Marion's been great.
Yeah, they see the talent that you have, and they're willing to help you well with that.
I like to think that's the case. Yeah.
Don't you see yourself as having talent?
I mean, but big pun.
Don't you see yourself as having talent?
I see well. It's for others to say. I think myself as a, we say in England, a grafter. That means something different in the US.
Mm-hmm.
I see myself as someone who's got a small amount of talent, which I stretch a long way by working quite hard. And I think, you know, to some extent, the larger part of the job is the work.
Right.
And I think, you know, it's just that it's how far you can stretch the talent.
Mm-hmm.
I think most writers, unless they're geniuses like Charles Dickens or, for that matter, Scott Fitzgerald, have more or less the same amount of talent, and I think just some are able to sort of stretch it a little bit further than others.
Right, I wrote some of the terms.
I think myself really as a hard worker first and sort of probably talented.
Now, what does NKVD stand for?
Oh, well, now you're asking, and I couldn't actually pronounce the Russian exact equivalent, but all of these organizations were Russian secret police, and they were all descended from what was called the Cheka.
Oh, so we don't need to know what they stand for necessarily.
There was the Cheka, then there was the OGPU, mm-hmm. then there was the NKVD, then there was the MVD, and then finally there was the KGB.
Right.
And I think now the same organization goes by an even more modern acronym. It's the Russian secret police is a sort of constantly evolving thing as far as the letters and the alphabet are concerned, but really always amounts to the same thing, which is it's a criminally murderous bike organization.
One thing I do love, this term cunt cove. It's apparently some kind of earmuffs or something. It's a great term.
I'm glad. I'm glad you could say it. I don't think I would dare say it really in an interview, but there you go.
I just did.
Yeah.
I can't take it back now.
Yes.
Oh, it's cover. I wrote co. Why did I write co? I must have forgotten to write the R at the end.
Yes.
But it's actually. Is it? Are they like earmuffs or some kind of headpiece?
Well, it's what used to be called a side-by-side or a hat with a sort of long groove in the middle, if that kind of makes this clearer.
Yeah, very cool. I'm wondering, do you have an idea for another series after Bernie? Do you have more ideas? And will you write another children's series?
I've got another single children's book lined up, mm-hmm. finished. I don't know if I'd do another series lightly. I mean, really, quite often you rely on what people think in order for, you know, in order to make it work as a series. You know, people have to react to it relatively well. But I am planning a sort of a couple of standalone thrillers. further down the line.
Oh, no, that's cool. I like the sound of that. Because
one of which is set in Houston, actually. So.
Houston, of all places.
Yeah.
How cool is that? I can't.
Well, Houston is a great place, in my opinion. I went there with my family a couple of summers ago to research an idea I had. I spent some time with the FBI, who were enormously helpful and friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And quite different from what one imagines the Feds to be like. And this is the great thing about the United States. You know, people. This is an open society,
mm-hmm.
In a way that lots of European societies aren't. And people are willing to talk about things. It's not a perfect society by any means. Well, a few societies are, but it's an open society and it's a free society, and people are. Can talk, that's an increasingly rare thing, even in so-called democracies in the West.
Would you rather write adult books or children's books, or doesn't it matter? Do you get equal pleasure out of both?
I get equal pleasure. I mean, when I was writing my children's book quite recently, I was just in seventh heaven. I was having such a good time writing it. It was the wonderful thing about writing for children is it is incredibly liberating. You don't feel any need to be sophisticated or to be an expert wordsmith or anything like that. Really, the most important thing is to just let the story roll, because that's really all kids want.
Do you get letters from kids?
I do, yeah. I get lots of emails from kids.
Do you really? That's great.
The most rewarding things I have, because, when kids only write to you if they like you.
Right.
Like your book. They don't write to you to tell you you're rubbish.
Right. That's right. Exactly. Whereas adults will do that.
Those are treasures, those emails, especially from boys, because boys are a tougher ask than girls. Girls read lots more than boys. But when boys write to me, it's always something like, I never read many books, and then my mum gave me one of yours, and since then I've read all seven, and I love them. And, it means such a lot to sort of win a boy over.
Absolutely. Yeah.
For books, because you think, well, if nothing else, I'll go to my grave having made some readers, and that's increasingly sort of important.
I guess the adults can be harder on you, too. The adults are more critical, I would think.
Yeah, they only write to you when, they point out that, I got an email recently from a guy who said I'd mentioned a tram in Munich,
mm-hmm.
that it was a double-decker, and he said at the time there were only single-decker.
Oh, really?
Running in Munich, So, yeah, I have to put up with that kind of thing, I just wrote him a polite email saying thank you very much, and,
That's good information. Why didn't you tell me before I wrote the book?
So that's the sort of thing you get. And you think, why do they bother? Why do they, why write to someone and tell them, you're an expert on trams?
I think there are just people that like to correct other people. I think those people exist.
Yeah.
I think they get some kind of pleasure out of it.
Yeah, I guess so.
It's just amazing. So, I know you have a couple more places to go in your bookstore, and we actually have to let you go because I've run out of time here. I was told that I only had 30 minutes, and we've done the 30 minutes. It's been an absolute pleasure. I can't wait till you come back next year and we can talk to you again.
Thank you, David. It'll be my pleasure to do that.
Let's mention the book again. It's called A Man Without Breath. It's the ninth Bernie Gunther novel, and it's a beautiful book. I hope you all go out and buy it and read it, and it's fascinating. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.